Hello, welcome to the Philosopher's Zone. This is David Rutledge, and I'm wondering this week if you remember that old Monty Python sketch that features four philosophers from the University of Woolloomooloo. Don't worry, I'm not going to recite it, I'm not that kind of person, but it's pretty simple stuff. All four philosophers are comically exaggerated Australian stereotypes. They're all wearing khaki safari suits and cork hats, and they're all called Bruce. And I've always felt that part of the joke that animates that sketch is the idea that there should be four Australian philosophers. It's just intrinsically funny that they exist at all. Well, Monty Python were performing that sketch back in 1970, and while it's still funny enough today, I don't think many contemporary eyebrows would be raised at the notion of Australian philosophy. Certainly my guest this week has had no trouble in going out and finding 10 Australian philosophers and interviewing them for a recent book titled What Are They Thinking? Conversations with Australian Philosophers. It's a wonderful book, a fascinating series of conversations, and when I read it, I came away with a number of questions that I really needed to sit down with the author and talk about. Is there such a thing as an Australian philosophical tradition? Is there perhaps a streak of anti-intellectualism in Australian culture that makes it a difficult place in which to do philosophy? And how is academic philosophy responding to the pressure of universities being pushed to steer students away from the humanities and in the direction of STEM subjects that can turn them into job-ready graduates, as the bone-chilling phrase has it? Daniel Nellor is based in Melbourne. He's a writer of essays and plays and political speeches and much more, in addition to this excellent philosophy book, and I spoke with him this week.
I came to philosophy late, really. I mean, I came to academia itself pretty late. I was in my mid-20s by the time I got to university. But I'd always been interested in philosophy, and I'd read what I could of it, and I'd read what I could understand of it. One book that I read sort of early on was a tattered old thing I found in a secondhand bookshop, a book by a philosophy communicator, a British person called Brian McGee, who had written a book of conversations, interviews with contemporary philosophers from the sort of mid-20th century. And that book sparked my interest. And in a way, that's come back as the kind of book that I've tried to put together for myself this year. But I ended up at university and did history and philosophy, found them both completely engrossing, but had to choose one or the other and ended up doing a PhD in philosophy under the supervision of Christopher Cordner, a moral philosopher there at Melbourne University. So that was my background. And after doing that, I wanted to think about a way I could keep doing philosophy, and that's what this book became.
Yeah, interesting that your background is in moral philosophy. That's always an interesting one to me. Particularly this question of how should we live, which is, I guess, the central question in moral philosophy. How do you approach that question?
I approach it perhaps a little differently to many people. Moral philosophy, one thing that it tries to do is think about where we get this sense that we ought to behave in certain ways and we ought not to behave in other ways. Where does that come from? For some people, it's all about maximizing the greatest good for the greatest number. For others, it's the fact that we are rational beings and we can think about our behavior and our reason can lead us to these sort of moral rules or ways to live. For me, it's a little different. I think we should take very seriously the idea that value, moral value, is something we encounter in the world before we think about it. So you might think of a parent with a newborn child who holds the child in their arms and is just overwhelmed, really, struck by the value, the preciousness of that child. I think that's something that the parent doesn't reason their way to. It's not the end of an argument. It's not the end of any sort of chain of logic or reasoning, but rather it's something they find to be the case about the world, in this case, this little piece of the world that is their child. And I think that that kind of encounter in the world, that kind of encounter with what is, whatever word you want to use, precious or sacred or valuable, I think that forms something of what Christopher Cordner in my book calls the background of our moral lives. Now, a lot of philosophers would agree with that, but say we need to move away from that kind of intuition or experience and move to the realm of reason. And I would agree with that in part, but I think that what makes my approach to moral philosophy a little distinctive is that I want to stay very close to those kinds of experiences as where morality comes from.
It's interesting that you displace reason and argument to a degree there in moral philosophy, because I do sometimes wonder, or I often wonder, if reason has a primacy of place in the Western philosophical tradition that can actually be problematic when it comes to understanding the world. Like, you can look at the world and see no end of examples where people are living or behaving according to something completely other than reason, and of course that's bad. But philosophers will often say, well, what those people need is to reacquaint themselves with reason. We need better education. We need sharper critical faculties. We need more philosophy, essentially. And I wonder if you think that that is, in fact, what we need.
I do think we need that, but I don't think we only need that. So where I think reason becomes very, very important in moral philosophy, at least in the way I approach it, is in teasing out some of the implications of some of these experiences that we have, like the experience of holding a newborn child. But another example might be something the philosopher Raymond Gaita talks about, where he talks about something that happens when you love someone. And one thing that happens when you love someone is that that person is revealed to you as someone who could be harmed. We need to be careful not to hurt this person. And then he goes on to say that if this person is revealed as someone who could be harmed, that's not something she can be simply as my beloved. That is, her vulnerability can't just be something that she acquires because I happen to love her. That must be something about her. That must be a bit of information about the world. And I think where reason comes in is, if we agree with that, thinking, okay, well, what are the implications of that for the people I don't love, the people I don't even like? What are the implications for morality in general or even politics? That's where I think reason comes in, but it can't get started if we don't have that initial experience, in my view, of encountering value in the world.
This all has a bearing, I think, a really interesting bearing on the question of how we know the things that we know, if we bring reason into it again, because the Cartesian model of knowledge acquisition is, of course, the rational individual sitting in his chair, refining his rational faculties, and it is a him. Whereas there is another model of knowledge that is a relational model, a social model, and it works quite differently. And this is something that the philosopher Dalia Nasar talks about in your book. Can you get into that a little? I find that really interesting.
That's right. Dalia really helped me think about knowledge as a two-way process. So it's, you know, traditionally, as you say, something we think of as something that we do to the object of our knowledge. So the sort of scientist with the test tube kind of model of knowledge. And we study something, we walk all around it, examine it from every angle. And by the end of this process, we know that thing. And when we know that thing, we can actually exercise power over that thing. And sometimes that's a very good thing, of course. So if a scientist comes to understand the way a particular kind of cancer works, that's a really good bit of knowledge, and it does lead to some power that we might gain over that cancer. It might mean that we can get rid of it. But sometimes that model of knowledge can be a less than good thing. For example, we have had in the West, I think, a tradition of approaching the environment as a thing to be known, to be understood, and in that way to gain control over the environment. And of course, that's led to a lot of exploitation in the situation we find ourselves in today. So Dalia Nasar talks about knowledge as more like a partnership, and not just a partnership between two people, but a partnership even between, say, me and the environment around me. So I'm not just the knower, and it's not just the known. In fact, what is going on there is that it is giving itself to me, revealing itself to me over time, not in a fixed way, but it's an ongoing relationship. And I need to take a more this is not her word, but mine, I guess, humble attitude towards the thing that I'm trying to know. So I think that's a really different way of looking at knowledge. As you say, it's perhaps not the traditional Western way, and it can be hard, I think, to get our heads around this way of looking at knowledge, but it may well be a necessary way of understanding or gaining a fuller and deeper understanding of what knowledge might be.
What's interesting about the book is that it's done in dialogue format, which puts it in a venerable philosophical tradition, but it also raises the question, why not just interview a bunch of philosophers and do a podcast, which is how people usually present philosophical conversations these days, this one being a case in point. What was the reasoning behind putting it out in book form?
Well, I love podcasts, and it's a golden age, and there are no end of long-form philosophical conversations out there, and I think that's a very, very good thing. But I also love writing, and philosophical writing in particular, and I really value that. So I guess in some ways I was trying to have the best of both worlds here, because I was hoping I could capture something of the freshness of a conversation, but combine that with, I suppose, the care that we can take when we have the opportunity to go back, to rethink, to revise. And so what we did with these conversations is that we had the initial conversation, but the sort of agreement was that that wouldn't be considered final, that I would go away and write up a draft of that, and that the philosopher themselves would then have the opportunity to revise that draft, and that would come back to me, and it could go back and forth as many times as it took until we were both happy. And so really the dialogue, such as it is happening in a way on two levels. There's the initial dialogue that we had in the moment, and that's got that, again, freshness and spontaneity about it. But then there's the sort of second or meta dialogue, if you like, that goes on when we both have the opportunity to think about what we said, revise it, go a little deeper, really add and subtract as much as we want. And really that's, I think, something that philosophy has to do. It has to think and rethink. It's not a process of thinking. It's a process, in a way, of rethinking. And so this book was an opportunity to try to capture a bit of both of those aspects of philosophy.
What were your selection criteria for who got to be included in the book?
Well, they weren't very strict. First and foremost, it was about someone who interested me. So I needed to find people whose work touched on something that interested me, but which is not to say it had to be my cup of tea or my area of philosophy. In fact, the second consideration was that I really wanted a variety of areas of philosophy. So I think I got that. I mean, there's logic and morality and politics and economics and the environment and technology, metaphysics, time, Buddhism, a number of different topics in the book, and I think that's a good thing. But they needed to have done something that interested me, captured my attention. I also wanted a variety of, I guess you'd say, career stages. So I have some people who have been in the game for a couple of years, others who have retired. In fact, one person was packing up her office more or less as we spoke. So that kind of variety as well. I wanted a gender balance, and I wondered if that might be a difficult thing to get. Turns out it wasn't. There were very, very many women philosophers out there who were doing fantastic things, and I think that's a tribute to some of the women philosophers of the recent past, because I don't think that would have necessarily been true 20 or even 10 years ago.
On Radio National and the ABC Listen app, you're with me, David Rutledge, and this is The Philosopher's Zone, and this week I'm speaking with Daniel Nellore, who's the author of What Are They Thinking? Conversations with Australian Philosophers. Publication details at the end of the show. The first question that you ask each philosopher in the book is, what is philosophy? Which is always a wonderful question, because the answer seems perfectly self-evident until you actually try to articulate it. So when you ask these philosophers to tell you what philosophy is, whose answer maybe surprised you? Did you have a favourite?
I think everyone's answer had something to recommend it, which in itself is part of what's interesting about philosophy. I would say that Margaret Cameron had some interesting stuff to say. She reminded me that, you know, philosophy is very much something, particularly in the West, that comes from a particular tradition, had a sort of a starting place, a starting time, and has been a tradition that's gone on from there. And that's important to remember, I think, that sort of historical dimension of philosophy. It's not just something that happens in a vacuum. It's totally conditioned by its time and place. So in a way, philosophy is a tradition that we enter into and add to, I guess, ourselves. Christopher Cordner reminded me that really the best way to answer the question, what is philosophy, is by doing some. And that's exactly right. I mean, I asked each of those philosophers that question. They gave very interesting answers. But really, you find out what they think philosophy is once you start talking to them about the philosophy that they do. Dalia Nasser gave another very interesting answer. She spoke about philosophy being the sort of ideal for any academic discipline, that perhaps all academic disciplines should be aiming to do the kinds of things philosophy does, that is, be self-critical, be self-reflective, examine the tools, the methods that you use, examine the values that you're bringing into play. All of that thing, all of that reflectiveness of philosophy is perhaps a model for every discipline.
But we do see in the history of philosophy, don't we, a certain resistance to that idea of self-criticism, self-reflection. In your conversation with Bronwyn Finnegan, who's at the Australian National University, she makes the very good point that what is philosophy is a question that very few philosophers actually address. Do you agree with her on that? And do you think that all philosophers should address that question first and foremost?
I think the pragmatic reason why many of them may not address that question is simply that whenever a philosopher asks a question, they have to be prepared to take a lot of time with it, to really go deep with it and be patient. And so simply by asking any one question, you kind of rule out working on any other area of philosophy for a while. And if they all devoted themselves to the question, what is philosophy, they may not get anything else done. But in a way, as I say, they are at least answering the question, even if they're not explicitly asking it. So the considerations that they bring to bear when they do philosophy, those themselves form an answer to, I think, what they think philosophy is. So whether everyone needs to ask that question explicitly, I'm not sure. As I say, they may not have the time, the energy to do it, but also they are asking and answering it in the process of actually doing philosophy.
I wonder if it's also the case, though, that if philosophy does have a certain resistance to reflecting on its own nature, its own history, is that the reflection is not necessarily a flattering one, insofar as philosophy has traditionally invested a lot of intellectual capital in the idea of its own specialness, in particular its distinctness from things like literature. I mean, this is a great point that Nietzsche makes. Do you think that there's something in that?
I do think that there's something in that. And I mean, philosophy has its arrogance, just like any other discipline can, I suppose. Yes, philosophy can from time to time set itself up against other forms of, I guess, human inquiry, human endeavor, such as art and literature. It's, to me, got to have a very, very close relationship to all of those things. And the further it gets away from them, the further it will feed that, I guess, sense of philosophy being an elitist thing that happens in an ivory tower somewhere and doesn't really have much bearing on the world.
I think we could all agree that philosophy is important insofar as we're talking about lowercase p philosophy, like just the philosophical turn of mind, the capacity to exercise a degree of reason and logic and weigh arguments on their own merits and so on. What about academic philosophy? Why is that important?
Well, I think part of the answer to that is that if we take the example of tennis, most people can have a game of tennis if they want to. Some people do it really, really, really well. And we all watch them doing it at the Australian Open. Now, in the case of tennis, I choose not to do tennis, but I don't think you can actually choose not to do small p philosophy, as you put it. So I think all of us at times find ourselves, even if it's only sitting in a chair, staring at a clock on a wall and wondering, what is time? How does it pass? What a mysterious thing that is, just for a split second and then moving on to something else. We all ask these questions. Some people devote themselves to asking those questions in a particularly focused and careful and rigorous way, and those are who we call professional philosophers, and they do that in academic settings. So, of course, we can all do it and we should all do it, but it doesn't hurt, I think, to have people who are devoted to doing it as well as it can possibly be done.
There is the issue of how often academic philosophers come up with answers to those questions. There are plenty of critics of the discipline of philosophy who say that all philosophy ever does is just restate the questions, and that answers are very thin on the ground. And there will be philosophers who admit that themselves. Do you go along with that?
Yeah, I don't see that as a negative, perhaps strangely. It's interesting to ask why I don't see that as a negative. Philosophy certainly doesn't, to my mind, make progress in the way that science makes progress. I think Margaret Cameron in the book makes the point that you can be an Aristotelian as a philosopher. That is, you can follow Aristotle. And Aristotle lived, of course, 2,500 years ago or so. You wouldn't say as a scientist that you were a follower of any particular scientist from 2,500 years ago. So what is the difference? Well, I can only answer that really with a metaphor, but I think it's a metaphor of depth. We ask the same questions and we give answers, but then we question those answers. And I hope that as we do that, we go deeper. We certainly don't go forward, to use a different spatial metaphor. But as I say, the option is not to stop asking the questions. We will ask the questions. And the question is, are we going to ask them with care, time, rigor, or not?
We often talk about the French philosophical tradition, the German philosophical tradition, the American, the British philosophical tradition. What about the Australian philosophical tradition? Are there distinctive qualities in Australian philosophy that you think point to an identifiably Australian philosophical tradition?
It's a really interesting question, and it's a question that many people have asked me when I've told them about this book. But it's not actually a question that I was pursuing in doing this book. I was more interested in just what are the questions these philosophers happen to be asking and how are they answering them. But having said that, I'm not sure there is a distinctively Australian philosophical tradition. There have been movements such as Australian materialism, or as it's sometimes called, Australian realism, in the mid-20th century, that people have said are a distinctly Australian approach to philosophy. But, you know, if someone was to try to characterise Australian philosophy as exhibiting that kind of harsh reductionist materialism, then I think they'd be on the wrong track. I think there's much more variety in it than that. The other thing to say, of course, is that philosophy is more and more global. And not all my philosophers were Australian, despite the title, but they're working in Australia. But they've come from different parts of the world, and they've brought with them, I think, their own distinctive traditions from those parts of the world. And I think that can only be a good thing. One thing that I think we are in perhaps a unique position to do in Australian philosophy, though I'm not sure we're doing it, is exploring in sensitive ways how Australian Indigenous thought might engage with some of the central themes, concerns, questions that we ask in Western philosophy. It would be not a straightforward thing to do, in some ways a very difficult thing to do, but we have this deep wisdom. We are all human, and I would like to think that there'd be a way of exploring our common humanity by finding ways to engage with First Nations thought. As I say, I'm not sure that it's being done. It may well be being done, but it should be done, I think.
There is, I think, and maybe always has been, a certain anti-intellectual streak in Australian culture. Do you agree that that's the case? And does it make Australia, in some sense, a less congenial place to be a philosopher than other parts of the world?
I'm not sure if there's an anti-intellectual streak here that's any greater than you might find anywhere else. Certainly, if you look around America, I think you could find some pretty solid anti-intellectual views, but they have a pretty robust philosophical tradition there. So I don't know if it's worse here than anywhere else. What I would say is I would wonder if there is an anti-intellectualism out there, whether it's worth thinking about where that comes from and why it exists. And I wonder if there might be a fear there that people who engage in intellectual activities like philosophy are sort of doing it to gain power over other people or to be better than other people. And if that is a fear, if that's a concern that may drive some of the anti-intellectualism that we see in Australia, then I think the answer to that is for philosophy to redouble its efforts to be inclusive, be open, be outward focused, and not turn in on itself in any way. And I think that's what you do in your program, and I think that's what I'm trying to do in this book, is simply to say that, look, we all do this actually. We don't do it necessarily in the technical language that philosophers do it. We don't do it perhaps with the same amount of effort and time as professional philosophers do it, but we do all ask questions and we can all participate to some extent in philosophy.
I guess maybe when I say an anti-intellectual streak, maybe really what I mean is an anti-humanities streak. And this is something that I think we have seen in recent years. We saw it under the previous government, this push for universities to be churning out job-ready graduates, quote-unquote, the massive increase in fees for humanity degrees. What's going on there, do you think, with respect to how much respect intellectual labour gets in Australia?
Well, shortly after commencing this book, it was announced that philosophy needed to be, among a few other subjects, disincentivised for students. And as you say, they chose to do that by tripling the price of doing it, because we didn't want people to choose it. We wanted people to choose things that, as you say, would make them job ready. So I guess I sort of felt, well, if I didn't have a good reason to be doing this book before, I certainly have one now to highlight the value of philosophy. Yeah, it was a disturbing move, and it's part of a longer trend of valuing things about a university that lead to vocational outcomes. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with vocational outcomes. But I think when you displace philosophy and other humanities subjects from the university, you impoverish not only the students but the society as well. So I wanted to show that philosophy could be something that brought joy and intellectual stimulation to people. And also, interestingly, it does make you job ready. It does help you get ready to work, because more and more in a knowledge economy, we are going to need people who can think deeply and creatively about what they do. And if philosophy doesn't train you for that, I don't know what does.
But I wonder if there's something about, I mean, I take your point about the things that philosophy trains you for, but I wonder if we're perhaps a little naive in telling prospective university graduates that learning for learning's sake is great, that university is about more than just fitting you out to get a job. I mean, these are things that I profoundly believe, and yet it's easy for me to believe that when I have a job. You know, I did my university degree in very different economic circumstances to the ones that we have today. And so while I deplore the attacks on the humanities that we've seen over the past few years, given that a philosophy degree is far more expensive and a far riskier investment today than it used to be, is it perhaps a little unfair to say to a high school student, yeah, just don't worry about any of that, just pursue your dream, you know, when maybe they should be worrying about the sordid realities of the job market?
I think I would say to a high school student, you should definitely worry about the sordid realities of the job market, and you should definitely think about employability, but also realise that whatever work you do, you'll be doing it as a human being. And when you go home from work, you'll still be a human being. And that if you're setting your future course based on the idea that you are nothing but your job, then you're setting yourself up, I think, for a life that could be richer than it is. So I wouldn't for a minute suggest that every single student should go and do philosophy for 3 years or 5 years or 6 years. But I think trying to get some philosophy in there through an arts degree or a breadth subject, as they're called in some places, is very, very important because, again, we are not just training our young people for work, but we are, I hope, preparing our young people for life.
Daniel, I'm always interested in the relationship between philosophy and art, particularly the literary arts. And there are a number of discussions about philosophy and art in your book. As a playwright yourself, presumably your interest in philosophy and your interest in drama intersect in various ways. Can you tell me a bit about that?
They do intersect in various ways. I'm not a big fan of art that has a message or a sort of teaching function. I think art needs a certain independence, freedom to go in any direction, even into disturbing directions, and that you can't necessarily take a bit of art and sort of distill it down to a political or a philosophical or any other kind of message. But having said that, of course, philosophy permeates art. Philosophical themes run through art from beginning to end. I once wrote a play about a philosopher, and when I got to the end of the play, I realized that if the play said anything, it sort of said something that was the complete opposite of what I'd said in my PhD thesis. And I think that was an interesting experience and a reminder that art can do something for philosophy. It might not be what you expect it to do. So I guess when I'm writing a play, I'm not thinking explicitly about philosophy. But what I am doing, of course, is writing in dialogue form. And dialogue form, as you mentioned earlier, is a traditional and a valuable way of doing philosophy, because philosophy is about, in the end, our lives together. It's not about me, it's about us. And so dialogue between philosophers is a really rich way to do philosophy. And I'm sure that part of the reason I'm attracted to playwriting in particular is that it gives you the ability to set up a number of voices who can then go back and forth, explore ideas together.
Well, your own book is a wonderful read. The conversational style, the dialogue mode, it just works fantastically well, and I really enjoyed reading it. What Are They Thinking? Conversations with Australian Philosophers. The author is Daniel Nellor. Daniel, it's been wonderful to talk. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
And What Are They Thinking? Is published by ASP, that's Australian Scholarly Publishing. You can find details on the Philosopher's Zone website, where you can also find a link to lots more info about Daniel Nellor. And that's it from me, David Rutledge. Thanks so much for your company, and I hope you can join me next time right here in the Philosopher's Zone. Bye for now.
Hello, it's Meredith Lake. Just popping in to let you know about the all-new season of Soul Search, the show curious about the big questions of how we make and find meaning.
This incessant human drive, even desperation, to uncover, to discover, to go deeper into the truth of things.
I like to think of Soul Search as a place where you and I can go deeper, to feel the weight of yearning and delight in the things that bring wonder.
This is the best of what it is to be human. This is literally why we're on this earth, is for these moments that can transcend and that bind us together.
So why not bring your questions, bring your hopes, bring your curiosity and your convictions, and join me for Soul Search this year as I sit down with all kinds of people to explore contemporary religion and spirituality.
These traditions, these experiences, these multiple generations that come before you, the landscape that forms you and in which you're embedded,
the different things that might shape us and shape our search for meaning. You can join me for Soul Search anytime with the podcast, which you can find on the ABC Listen app.
That's a very rich place.